and you'll see more of a mainstream, center-right populist movement. Clinton's speech struck a chord with many members of the media because it helped to explain the torrent of abuse they were experiencing, especially on social media platforms such as Twitter. The storyline that Clinton's staff hoped her speech would produce did indeed emerge, and the negative coverage of Bannon and Trump and their relationship to the alt-right carried on for weeks. It was a subject any ordinary campaign would be toxically afraid of, but it didn't produce the political dynamic Clinton expected. Her lead actually narrowed in the month after her speech, from 6 points to 2 points in the Real Clear Politics average of polls. Bannon thought he knew why. "We polled the race stuff, and it doesn't matter," he said in late September. "It doesn't move anyone who isn't already in her camp." What became much more worrisome for the Trump campaign was sex and sexual assault. On October 7th, David Farenthold, a reporter at The Washington Post, was leaked outtake footage from a 2005 Trump appearance on the NBC show Access Hollywood. In the tape, the recently married Trump is heard bragging in lewd and graphic detail to the show's host, Billy Bush, about kissing, groping, and trying to bed women. "When you're a star, they let you do it," Trump says. "You can do anything. Grab them by the pussy." From the moment it posted at 4 p.m. on Friday, Farenthold's story drew such heavy traffic that it briefly crashed the Post's internal servers. Republican politicians seized up in panic. Many believed it was the death knell of Trump's campaign, a prospect they secretly welcomed, given the reliably orthodox conservatism and resolute dullness of Trump's running mate, Mike Pence. South Dakota Senator John Thune, the third-ranking member of the GOP leadership, echoed many of his colleagues by calling on Trump to quit the race. "Donald Trump should withdraw, and Mike Pence should be our nominee effective immediately." House Speaker Paul Ryan announced he would no longer support or defend Trump's campaign, though he didn't withdraw his endorsement. "I am not going to defend Donald Trump, not now, not in the future," Ryan told his House colleagues in a private conference call. RNC Chairman Reince Priebus, scheduled to appear on the Sunday morning shows, promptly withdrew, and New York later reported that he went to see Trump at his penthouse and advised him to quit or go down with a worse election loss than Barry Goldwater's. Trump, who made it a point never to apologize for any offense, took the unprecedented step of expressing remorse in a hastily produced 90-second web video. "I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize," Trump said to the camera. But his apology quickly morphed into an attack on the Clintons that made clear he would not be dropping out. "I've said some foolish things," he said, "but Bill Clinton has actually abused women, and Hillary has bullied, attacked, shamed, and intimidated his victims. We will discuss this more in the coming days. See you at the debate on Sunday." Inside Trump's campaign, there was a frantic rush to staunch the damage. Trump was stung by the string of Republican defections, and he raged against Ryan and took note of who loyally stood by him: a small circle of family members, Bannon, Bossie, and Giuliani, but not Priebus, Ryan, or Christie. Kushner, too, was bitterly disposed toward Ryan, a dynamic Bannon worried about, despite his own history of antagonism, because he feared it would divide the GOP. "It takes coalitions to win wars," he said, drawing a characteristically dramatic analogy. "It's just like Americans working with the Russians in World War II. Defeat the fascists, then we'll fight amongst ourselves. We can have the long Cold War after that." He tried, and mostly failed, to stop Trump from criticizing Ryan. The loyal circle also included the Mercers. The next morning, Robert and Rebecca Mercer issued a rare public statement reaffirming their support for Trump, while signaling to Republicans who wanted their money that they should tread carefully. Donald Trump's uncensored comments, both old and new, have been echoed and dissected in the media repeatedly, in an effort to kindle among his supporters a conflagration of outrage commensurate with the media's own faux outrage. Could anyone really be surprised that Mr. Trump could have said to Mr. Bush such things as he has already admitted saying? No. We are completely indifferent to Mr. Trump's locker room braggadocio. We have a country to save, and there is only one person who can save it. We, and Americans across the country and around the world, stand steadfastly behind Donald J. Trump. Still, by Saturday afternoon, Bannon could feel the crisis spiraling out of control. When a reporter reached him to ask what the campaign was planning for the next evening's debate against Clinton, and whether a show of contrition might be warranted, Bannon didn't miss a beat. Attack, 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 attack. Trump didn't wait for Sunday night's debate to deliver. Bannon had long been convinced from his conversations with the Valkyries, his young female Breitbart reporters, that Bill Clinton's womanizing and Hillary's complicity in covering it up had more political salience than conventional wisdom allowed, and was something that has to be concentrated and brought up, as he'd put it a year earlier. His original thought was that relitigating the scandals would demoralize a younger generation of feminist women, unfamiliar with the details, whom Clinton was counting on for support. But with the Access Hollywood tape, Bannon saw that injecting Clinton's accusers into the heat of the presidential race would muddy the waters and force the media to devote attention to more than just Trump's damaging tape. The trick was to do it in a way that couldn't be ignored. On Sunday afternoon, 90 minutes before the start of the debate at Washington University in St. Louis, word spread among the press corps that Trump was about to hold an event. As reporters squeezed into a conference room, Trump was seated at the center of a makeshift dais draped with black cloth and flanked by four elderly women well known to veteran political reporters: Kathleen Willey, Juanita Broderick, Kathy Shelton, and Paula Jones. Willey, Broderick, and Jones had all accused Bill Clinton of sexual assault. In 1975, a judge had appointed Hillary Clinton, then a young lawyer, to defend a man accused of raping Shelton, who was then 12 years old. After brief prefatory remarks from Trump, the women took turns defending him and attacking the Clintons. "Mr. Trump may have said some bad words, but Bill Clinton raped me," Broderick alleged. "And Hillary Clinton threatened me. I don't think there's any comparison." The shock of what was unfolding prompted frenzied live coverage on cable news, while the Trump campaign streamed the event on Facebook. As cameras panned the room, they captured Bannon standing in the back, grinning wickedly. Even though reporters shouted questions at Trump about the Access Hollywood tape, the brazen theatrics of Bannon's gambit and the visual of Trump seated among Clinton's accusers guaranteed that the primary imagery on television would cease to be the Access Hollywood footage, which had run in a nonstop loop for 2 days and would be replaced by Trump's latest outrageous stunt. Watching Bill Cosby succumb to his accusers the year before, Bannon had noticed that their on-camera testimony was especially powerful because most of the victims had been attacked decades earlier and were now elderly women and thus inherently sympathetic. Bannon thought a similar dynamic would apply to the Clinton accusers, and he worked to get them as much camera time as he could. One method he planned to use was to put the women at the front of the debate audience in seats reserved for Trump's family, to unnerve Hillary Clinton and assure them a steady presence in the camera shot. He and Kushner had hit upon the plan after seeing Mark Cuban, the billionaire owner of the Dallas Mavericks and an outspoken Clinton partisan, seated in the front row during the first debate on September 26th. Trump personally approved the idea, understanding that it would create an indelible moment of TV drama. The candidate's family members were to enter the debate hall at the same time and shake hands, which would put Bill Clinton face-to-face with his accusers. "We were going to put the four women in the VIP box," Giuliani explained. "We had it all set. We wanted to have them shake hands with Bill, to see if Bill would shake hands with them." But minutes before the proceedings were to begin, Frank Fahrenkopf, co-chairman of the debate commission, learned of the plan and forbade Trump's staff from following through. Bannon urged them to go ahead anyway, to no avail. Fahrenkopf said no, verbally said no, that security would throw them out, Giuliani said. We pulled it because we were going to have a big incident on national TV. When Clinton was introduced, she refused the traditional pre-debate handshake with Trump. In the end, defusing the Bannon-Kushner plan made little difference because Trump quickly took matters into his own hands. As 67 million people watched, Trump waited for the inevitable Access Hollywood question and sprung his counterattack. If you look at Bill Clinton, far worse, he said. Mine are words, and his was action. His was, what he's done to women, there's never been anybody in the history of politics in this nation that's been so abusive to women. Hillary Clinton attacked those same women and attacked them viciously. Four of them are here tonight. Afterward, Bannon marveled at Trump's fearlessness. It's awe-inspiring, he said. You have to have a certain psychological construct to do that. He's got that. Classic honey badger. He crushed her. 2 days later, Trump's internal tracking polls gave some credence to Bannon's enthusiasm. By now, Trump's campaign was following a familiar pattern. Whenever he made news for some negative event, attacking the cons, a poor first debate performance, his support would erode, but then recover, like a balloon pushed underwater. In the first debate on September 26th, Trump had looked badly overmatched, and he lost support. Within a week, his numbers were climbing. Then the Access Hollywood tape landed on October 7th, and they dropped again. But 4 days later, they once again began to recover. Outside the campaign, Trump's tape fiasco was regarded as a mortal blow, and the Clinton accuser gambit a transparently cynical ploy to change the subject. But on the inside, Trump's brain trust was seeing numbers that said attacking Clinton was the way to go. Besides, they couldn't have stopped Trump if they'd wanted to. A smattering of public polls indicated the same thing, including one from October 12th taken by NBC News SurveyMonkey, which showed more respondents improved their opinion of Trump than they did Clinton after watching the second debate. But that same day, a Wednesday, multiple women came forward to accuse Trump of having groped or kissed them without their consent. Two went public in a front-page New York Times story. A third told the Palm Beach Post that Trump had grabbed my ass 10 years earlier. The fourth, a former People magazine reporter, published an essay recounting how Trump had forcibly kissed her at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, before an interview she was going to conduct with him and his pregnant wife, Melania. Twisting the knife, Michelle Obama went after Trump directly in a speech the next day. This wasn't just locker room banter, she told the crowd in Manchester, New Hampshire. This was a powerful individual speaking freely and openly about sexually predatory behavior. Trump was incensed at the ambush and delivered an angry rebuttal at a rally in West Palm Beach, charging his accusers with being part of a global conspiracy and attacking them individually. The Clinton machine is at the center of this power structure, Trump said, delivering prepared remarks that bore the mark of Bannon. Anyone who challenges their control is deemed a sexist, a racist, a xenophobe, and morally deformed. They will attack you. They will slander you. They will seek to destroy your career and your family. They will lie, lie, lie. Democrats were giddy, believing that they were finally witnessing the self-destruction of a candidate who seemed impervious to so much. Paul Begala, an advisor to the Clinton-aligned Super PAC Priorities USA, watched Trump's rally and pronounced him finished. To quote the late, great Nelson Mandela, it's like drinking poison and thinking it's going to hurt your enemy, Begala said. He's a billionaire tycoon in a total meltdown, and he's going to try to take as many people down with him. It's not a political strategy, but it will be an unlovely 26 days until we dispatch him to the ash heap of history. The wave of new accusers put Trump's campaign on a war footing. With Trump himself appearing increasingly unhinged, Bannon's instinctive hyper-aggressiveness met no internal resistance. The distinction they needed to draw, he told staffers, was between Trump's locker room behavior and what he alleged was Hillary Clinton's history of enabling sexual violence. "This has nothing to do with consensual sexual affairs and infidelities," Bannon said in a strategy meeting that week. "This is Bill. We're going to turn him into Bill Cosby. He's a violent sexual predator who physically abuses women who he assaults, and she takes the lead on the intimidation of the victims." Bossie reached out to reporters to explain how the campaign intended to drive this narrative. Clinton had tweeted in November, "Every survivor of sexual assault deserves to be heard, believed, and supported." The juxtaposition of that claim and the aggressiveness with which she and her allies had attacked her husband's accusers over the years was, Bossie claimed, a glaring hypocrisy. "It's untenable and it's farcical," he said. "With rape culture being what it is, these facts are going to shock millennial women. There will not be a millennial woman who will want to vote for her when these facts come out." Summing up the strategy for the final stretch of the race, a Trump advisor said, "We're going to go buck wild." Trump was certainly game. At a fundraiser that week, he declared himself unshackled and seemed to relish the prospect of ramping up his attacks on Clinton, who he and Bannon both believed was orchestrating the parade of accusers. "A vote for Hillary is a vote to surrender our government to public corruption, graft, and cronyism that threatens the survival of our constitutional system itself," he told an Arizona crowd soon after. "What makes us exceptional is that we are a nation of laws and that we are all equal under those laws. Hillary's corruption shreds the principle on which our nation was founded." On television and on the front pages of the major newspapers, Trump clearly seemed to be losing the election. Each new woman who came forward with charges of misbehavior became a focal point of coverage, coupled with Trump's furious reaction, his ever-darkening speeches, and the accompanying suggestion that they were dog whistles aimed at racists and anti-Semites. Trump's remarks, one Washington Post story explained, summing up the media's outlook, were laced with the kind of global conspiracies and invective common in the writings of the alternative right, white nationalist activists who see him as their champion. Some critics also heard echoes of historical anti-Semitic slurs in Trump's allegations that Clinton meets in secret with international banks to plot the destruction of U.S. sovereignty, and that media and financial elites were part of a soulless cabal. This outlook, which Clinton's campaign shared, gave little consideration to the possibility that voters might be angry at large banks, international organizations, and media and financial elites for reasons other than their basest prejudices. This was the axis on which Bannon's nationalist politics hinged, the belief that, as Marine Le Pen put it, "the dividing line is no longer between left and right, but globalists and patriots." Even as he lashed out at his accusers and threatened to jail Clinton, Trump's late campaign speeches put his own stamp on this idea. As he told one rally, "There is no global anthem, no global currency, no certificate of global citizenship. From now on, it's going to be America first." Anyone steeped in Guénon's traditionalism would recognize the terrifying specter Trump conjured of marauding immigrants, Muslim terrorists, and the collapse of national sovereignty and identity as the descent of a dark age, the Kali Yuga. For the millions who are not familiar with it, Trump's apocalyptic speeches came across as a particularly forceful expression of his conviction that he understood their deep dissatisfaction with the political status quo and could bring about a rapid renewal. Whether it was a result of Trump's apocalyptic turn, disgust at the Clintons, or simply accuser fatigue, it was likely a combination of all three. The pattern of slippage in the wake of negative news was less pronounced in Trump's internal surveys in mid-October. Overall, he still trailed. But the data were noisy. In some states, Indiana, New Hampshire, Arizona, his support eroded, but in others, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, it actually improved. When Trump held his own at the third and final debate on October 19th, the numbers inched up further. The movement was clear enough that Nate Silver and other statistical mavens began to take note of it. "Is the presidential race tightening?" he asked in the title of an October 26th article. Citing Trump's rising favorability numbers among Republicans and red state trend lines, he cautiously concluded that probably it was. By November 1st, he had no doubt. "Yes, Donald Trump has a path to victory," read the headline for his column that day, in which he noted that Clinton's lead in national polls had shrunk from 7 points in mid-October down to 3 or 4 points. "Trump remains an underdog," Silver wrote, "but no longer really a long shot." By that point, Trump's data scientists had already arrived at the same conclusion. And then, peering into their models, they'd gone a step further and convinced themselves that the electorate was going to look different from what almost anyone else was anticipating. If they were right, there was a much clearer path to 270 electoral votes than most experts were allowing, one that stretched across the industrial upper Midwest. To Bannon, this made intuitive sense, but one thing gave him pause. The Clinton campaign showed no sign at all that the Midwestern states Trump's scientists now considered winnable were even in play. As he had done periodically throughout the fall, he posed a question to a reporter he knew that had nagged at him for weeks. "What is Clinton doing? What's their strategy? It's a week from Election Day, and she's in Arizona." 11. The FBI has learned of the existence. Throughout everything, Hillary Clinton was seeing a different race. From the earliest days of her campaign, when private polls suggested that some 10 million people who'd voted Democratic in 2012 now said they were supporting Trump, she and her advisors had refused to believe it. Those voters may be frustrated and disillusioned. They may be sending a message, but in the end, they were Democrats. They would come home to Clinton. She need not waste time and resources to persuade them. So certain of this was Clinton's campaign that in the final weeks of the race, confident of victory and hoping for a landslide, she traveled to red states such as Arizona that she imagined were within her grasp and ignored the upper Midwest until it was too late. "We're already seeing the effects of climate change, and I have a plan to increase renewable energy that will create millions of clean energy jobs that can't be exported. They've got to be done right here in Arizona," Clinton belted out to 10,000 rally-goers in Tempe a week before the election. This bid to broaden the map was no head fake. "Arizona ain't an indulgence," tweeted her communications director, Brian Fallon. "It's a true battleground. Perhaps even more favorable looking right now than some other places we've been on TV." Clinton's plan all along was to reactivate the same coalition of Democratic-leaning groups that had twice delivered Barack Obama to the White House: young people, minorities, and suburban women. That's why she embraced the Black Lives Matter movement and vowed to protect from deportation a larger segment of the illegal immigrant community than Obama had. And if she could also carry states like Arizona that Obama hadn't won, then her electoral mandate would be that much bigger. The reason Clinton's moves so puzzled the Trump campaign is that just before she traveled to Arizona, Trump's data analysts had become convinced, based on absentee ballots and early voting, that the people who were going to show up on Election Day would be older, whiter, more rural, and more populous than almost anyone else believed. So they reweighted their predictive models to reflect a different electorate. As much as anything, this was a leap of faith. It's what gnawed at Bannon and other Trump advisors in the closing days of the race. But in the end, what other choice did they have? If he was going to win this election, it was going to be because of a Brexit-style mentality and a different demographic trend than other people were seeing, said Matt Oskowski, a senior official at Cambridge Analytica, working in Trump's campaign. Imagining a more Trump-friendly turnout changed the composition of the electoral map, and with it, Trump's strategy for the closing weeks of the race. On October 18th, before the numbers had been reweighted, the campaign's internal election simulator, dubbed the Battleground Optimizer Path to Victory, gave Trump a 7.8% chance of winning the 270 electoral votes he needed. His long odds were mainly due to the fact that he trailed, albeit narrowly, in most of the states that looked like they would decide the election, including the all-important state of Florida. Reweighting the model to reflect an older, whiter electorate changed the polls by only a couple of percentage points in most of the major battleground states. But it shifted the odds of victory substantially in Trump's direction, because it either put him ahead or made him newly competitive in states such as Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, where he'd previously trailed or hadn't looked to have a real chance. Arizona wasn't competitive for Clinton in either of Trump's models. Trump's path to victory was now illuminated. Something else was happening, too. On October 25th, Trump's internal polls showed his support ticking up in nearly every battleground state, a trend that continued over the next 3 days. Out on the trail, Trump was stepping up his angry screeds, traducing Clinton, whom he accused of plotting the destruction of U.S. sovereignty in order to enrich these global financial powers, her special interest friends, and her donors. At first, this seemed like an expression of primal rage from a man of towering ego who understood, even if only subconsciously, that he was headed for a historic comeuppance. But then Republican voters started to respond in a way that established politicians couldn't have imagined just 2 weeks earlier, when the Access Hollywood tape upended the race. Against all odds, Trump's support steadily consolidated and forced Republican lawmakers who had piously abandoned him to make a humiliating volte-face. The most satisfying for several Trump advisers was that of Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz, a media-hungry weather vane of popular sentiment who had been among the first to withdraw his endorsement of Trump in the wake of the tape scandal. "I'm out. I can no longer in good conscience endorse this person for president," Chaffetz told Utah's Fox 13 News on October 8th. "My wife, Julie, and I, we have a 15-year-old daughter," he said to CNN's Don Lemon later that night. "Do you think I can look her in the eye and tell her that I endorsed Donald Trump for president when he acts like this?" Not 3 weeks later, on October 26th, under pressure from angry constituents, Chaffetz flip-flopped and announced on Twitter that he would indeed be voting for Trump. And then the bombshell landed. Early in the afternoon of Friday, October 28th, James Comey, the director of the FBI, sent a letter to Congress announcing that new evidence had emerged in the case relating to Hillary Clinton's emails. In connection with an unrelated case, the FBI has learned of the existence of emails that appear to be pertinent to the investigation, he wrote. The unrelated case involved sexually explicit text messages sent by former Representative Anthony Weiner to a 15-year-old girl in North Carolina. Weiner was married to Huma Abedin, one of Clinton's close aides, who had saved some of Clinton's emails on Weiner's laptop. Having declared the Clinton email case closed in July, when he delivered an unprecedented public rebuke of her extremely careless conduct, Comey now told Congress that he was reopening the Clinton investigation. Ever since the New York Times broke the news on March 2, 2015, that Clinton used a personal email account and private server as Secretary of State, risking exposure of classified documents to hostile foreign powers, the subject of her emails had stalked her campaign, fusing with the damaging Clinton cash narrative to undermine the public's trust in her. Clinton had persevered through a criminal referral from the Justice Department, through countless congressional hearings, and through a nonstop barrage of attacks from hostile Republicans. Now, a controversy she thought was behind her came roaring back into the white-hot crucible of the presidential race. Clinton and her staff were incredulous. "We are 11 days out from perhaps the most important national election of our lifetimes," she said at a hastily arranged evening news conference. "Voting is already underway in our country, so the American people deserve to get the full and complete facts immediately." The director himself has said he doesn't know whether the emails referenced in his letter are significant or not. "Therefore, it's imperative that the Bureau explain this issue in question, whatever it is, without any delay." Inside Trump's campaign, the mood was ecstatic. Bannon's phone lit up with frantic text messages from reporters racing to get a comment on the shocking revelations. Bannon demurred. "Don't want to step on Comey's lines," he texted back. As the cable news networks hit DEFCON 1, he understood that the worst thing the Trump campaign could do was to distract in any way from this damaging story. When the news broke, Trump was just about to take the stage at a rally in Manchester, New Hampshire. As soon as he reached the lectern, he delivered the clip he knew the networks were waiting for. "I need to open with a very critical breaking news announcement," Trump said. "The FBI," he paused as the crowd cheered, "has just sent a letter to Congress informing them that they have discovered new emails pertaining to the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton's investigation." He paused once more as chants of "lock her up" swept through the hall. "They are reopening the case into her criminal and illegal conduct that threatens the security of the United States of America. Hillary Clinton's corruption is on a scale we have never seen before. We must not let her take her criminal scheme into the Oval Office." By the time Trump arrived at his next event, in Lisbon, Maine, he had hit upon an even better soundbite to capture Clinton's travails. "This," he told the audience, "is the biggest political scandal since Watergate." Over the next 11 days, Trump did something that he hadn't managed to do in months. He kept focused. Somehow, at this decisive final moment, he stuck to a script that extolled Bannon-style America First nationalism, while issuing elaborate condemnations of Clinton's character and moral corruption. He had reason to be encouraged. His internal polls, which showed him already ascending before the Comey letter, now had him turning sharply upward in every state and continuing to climb. On November 3rd, a report was circulated among Trump's top advisors that took note of the Comey effect. "The last few days have proven to be pivotal in the minds of voters, with the recent revelation in reopening the investigation of Secretary Clinton," it read. "Early polling numbers show declining support for Clinton, shifting in favor of Mr. Trump, suggesting this may have a fundamental impact on the race." 5 days out, Trump still trailed Clinton in nearly every public poll, and his forecasting model, although it showed improved odds of victory, still implied that a loss was the likelier outcome. And the Comey letter was not a panacea. The report noted that the jolt it gave Trump was already leveling off in all but a few places. "As of today, we have started to realize what the ceiling is in many states, though 4 states continue to rise: Pennsylvania, Indiana, Missouri, and New Hampshire," the report said. "We will continue tracking these states to hopefully understand where the continued movement takes us." Throughout the general election, both campaigns battled for a group of voters who would ultimately decide the race. While media outlets fixated on distinct character types considered representative of the election, the dispossessed factory worker registering to vote for Trump, the elderly woman longing to see a female president, the real competition between the campaigns was for voters of a less vivid hue. Trump's data analysts gave them a nickname: double haters. These were people who disliked both candidates, but traditionally showed up at the polls to vote. They were a sizable block. 3 to 5% of the 15 million voters across 17 battleground states that Trump's staff believed were persuadable. Early on, many indicated support for third-party candidate Gary Johnson. But after a series of televised flubs, including Johnson's admission that he didn't know what Aleppo was, it was a city caught in the middle of Syria's civil war, they largely abandoned him. What made the double haters so vexing to Trump's analysts was that their intentions were difficult to discern. Many refused to answer pollsters' questions or declared themselves undecided. The Clinton campaign thought of these persuadable voters as being mainly pocketbook Republicans, people whose votes were driven by kitchen-table economic concerns but were made deeply uncomfortable by Trump's racist and sexist outbursts. These were the voters Clinton had hoped to shear off from Trump with her alt-right speech in August. What we found is that they were very fickle. They'd toggle between telling pollsters that they were leaning Clinton or leaning Trump, depending on where the news cycle was that week, said Fallon. This is the largest piece of fallout we ascribe to the Comey letter. In ending the campaign on a note where people were reminded about the worst of our controversies, we saw those fickle, Republican-leaning voters that we've been successfully attracting off and on throughout the general election revert back to Trump at the end. For all their many differences, on this subject, the campaigns generally agreed. Comey's letter had the effect of convincing the double haters to finally choose an affiliation. Or, in the case of many who had been leaning toward Clinton, choose to stay home. What we saw is that it gave them a reason to vote against her instead of voting for him, said Matt Oskowski. They were finally able to admit that to pollsters without feeling any guilt. All of those double haters and last-minute undecideds started to break heavily toward Trump in the polling and research, when deep down, they were probably going to vote for him anyway. Now, they had a reason. There was nothing Clinton could do to stop them. As midnight approached on November 7th, a restive Trump audience was packed into the DeVos Place Convention Center in Grand Rapids, Michigan. On this single day, the last before Election Day, Trump had barnstormed across many of the states his campaign was now certain were in play: Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, and then one final rally in Michigan. Too late, Clinton had awoken to the danger of the tightening race. She too had swept through Pennsylvania twice and North Carolina, and had also visited Grand Rapids earlier in the day. Before Trump appeared, Ted Nugent hit the stage in a camouflage jacket and cap to play the Star-Spangled Banner on an electric guitar, shouting, "This is real Michigan." It was past midnight when Pence took the lectern to introduce the next president of the United States, Donald Trump. "So, you know, we added this stop about 12 minutes ago, and look at this place. Is this incredible?" Trump said. "We don't need Jay-Z or Beyonce. We don't need John Bon Jovi. We don't need Lady Gaga. All we need is great ideas to make America great again." For the last time as a candidate, Trump worked through all his famous tropes, pausing wistfully at times and basking in the crowd's energy. "We're hours away from a once-in-a-lifetime change," he said. "Today is our Independence Day. Today, the American working class is going to strike back," he said, marveling at the thought. "The election is now. Can you believe it? It's today." Soon, Trump and his audience slid into the familiar call-and-response rhythms of his rallies. "Hillary Clinton is the most corrupt person ever to seek the presidency of the United States. Lock her up. Lock her up. Our jobs are being stolen like candy from a baby. Not going to happen anymore, folks. Boo." "It used to be the cars were made in Flint, and you couldn't drink the water in Mexico. Now the cars are made in Mexico, and you can't drink the damned water in Flint. What the hell? Trump. 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 We're going to fix our inner cities. Right now they're so unsafe, you walk to the store to pick up a loaf of bread, you get shot. A Trump administration will also secure and defend the borders of the United States. And yes, we will also build a great, great wall. Build the wall. Build the wall. At this, Trump stepped back from the lectern and opened his arms, smiling at the audience. I just want to ask you one question, if you don't mind, at 1 a.m. He said, who is going to pay for the wall? Mexico! 100%, he said. They don't know it yet, but they're going to pay. In the end, he came back to his signature phrase, emblazoned on hats and placards throughout the hall. To all Americans tonight in all of our cities and all of our towns, I pledge to you one more time, together we will make America wealthy again. We will make America strong again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. And then Trump delivered one final importunement to the crowd. Go to bed, he told them. Go to bed right now. Get up and vote. On Election Day, Trump's forecasting model indicated that he probably wouldn't make it. Some of his advisors said his odds of victory were 30%. Others went as high as 40%. At least one advisor said, it will take a miracle for us to win. And then the world turned upside down. On the morning after the election, Bannon had barely slept. The sudden rush of victory, the drama of Clinton's concession call as Trump was about to take the stage, the glare of the spotlight in his eyes as he gazed out on the drunken, jubilant revelers in MAGA hats at the victory party, it left him in a fugue state. But now, as the sun came up over Manhattan, he could see how everything had come together exactly according to script. Hillary Clinton was the perfect foil for Trump's message, Bannon marveled to a reporter. From her email server, to her lavishly paid speeches to Wall Street bankers, to her FBI problems, she represented everything that middle-class Americans had had enough of. The beauty of it was that no one had seen her downfall coming. Their minds are totally blown, he said, laughing. Clinton's great mistake, the Democrats' great mistake, was one he recognized all too well, since he'd watched Republicans commit it during their anti-Clinton witch hunts of the 90s. They'd become so intoxicated with the righteousness of their cause, so thoroughly convinced that a message built on identity politics would carry the day and drown out the deplorables, that they became trapped in their own bubble and blind to the millions who disagreed with them. And that goes for you guys in the media, too, he added. Now Trump had shattered that illusion, and the wave that had swept across Europe and Great Britain had come crashing down on America's shores. Trump, Bannon proclaimed, is the leader of a populist uprising. What Trump represents is a restoration of true American capitalism, and a revolution against state-sponsored socialism. Elites have taken all the upside for themselves and pushed the downside to the working and middle-class Americans. Bernie Sanders had tried to warn them, but the Democrats hadn't listened and didn't break free of crony capitalism. Trump saw this, Bannon said. The American people saw this, and they have risen up to smash it. For all his early morning bravado, Bannon sounded as if he still couldn't quite believe it all. And what an incredible story it was. Given the central role he had played in the greatest political upset in American history, the reporter suggested that it had all the makings of a Hollywood movie. Without missing a beat, Bannon shot back a reply worthy of his favorite vintage star, Gregory Peck, in 12 O'Clock High. Brother, he said, Hollywood doesn't make movies where the bad guys win. Afterward, Kali Yuga. In the shell-shocked aftermath of the election, President Obama, looking shaken, appeared in the White House Rose Garden to deliver public remarks intended to project a sense of calm. A sense, really, that the basic stability of the country remained intact. The sun is up, Obama said. I know everybody had a long night. I did as well. I had a chance to talk to President-elect Trump last night, about 3:30 in the morning, I think it was, to congratulate him on winning the election. The next day, when the two men appeared together in the Oval Office, it felt as if the world had slipped through the looking glass. Trump quickly named Bannon his chief White House strategist. Republicans controlled every branch of government. With Trump's ability to defy every political norm, anything seemed possible. Who could argue otherwise after what had just transpired? And yet, within days of his inauguration, Trump's White House was plunged into chaos and scandal from which it has not recovered, and may never. Bannon, the imaginative reconceiver of U.S. politics, hung streams of paper listing Trump's promises from the walls of his West Wing office. His strategy, as always, was to launch furious attacks, this time to shock the system and rapidly reorient the federal government in a more nationalist direction. He called this, with what I took to be intentional irony, a shock-and-awe approach to asserting Trump's power. But Trump's flurry of activity quickly ran into problems. There was his executive order, sprung a week after his inauguration, banning immigrants from 7 majority Muslim countries, which set off nationwide protests and was blocked by the courts. His firing 2 weeks later of National Security Director Michael Flynn for contacts with the Russians. The collapse of his first major legislative initiative, a bill to repeal Obamacare. His firing of FBI Director James Comey. And the swift descent of the West Wing into a viper's nest of backstabbing and leaks. This quick turn toward a crack-up was hardly unforeseeable or even altogether surprising. But it contrasted sharply with the success of a candidate who had dominated his opponents, shaped news coverage, and shown himself to be all but impervious to forces that overwhelm other politicians. Bannon, whose wild gambits in the campaign had invariably paid off, seemed to run out of magic tricks once Hillary Clinton was no longer a target. The government wasn't as malleable to Trump and Bannon's aggressions as the Republican Party and the cable news channels had been, and they found themselves consistently thwarted and undermined by the courts, by right-wing hardliners in Congress, by their own inexperience and Trump's errant tweets, and by the bureaucracy they were now overseeing. The crises these failures precipitated in the White House cost Bannon much of his influence and soon threatened Trump's presidency. While it's still early in his term, the possibilities that Trump's most ardent supporters once imagined for his presidency already seem to be mostly foreclosed. I think there are 3 main reasons why Trump's administration has so quickly fallen into disorder and confusion. Trump thought being president was about asserting dominance. Just after he'd locked up the GOP nomination, Trump said something to me that crystallized his view of politics and explains, to my mind, much of his subsequent difficulties. "I deal with people that are very extraordinarily talented people," he told me. "I deal with Steve Wynn. I deal with Carl Icahn. I deal with killers that blow these politicians away. It's not even the same category. This," he meant politics, "is a category that's like 19 levels lower. You understand what I'm saying? Brilliant killers." Trump was equating politics with business, and the presidency with the job of being a big-shot CEO, a killer. He filled the upper ranks of his administration with people of a similar mindset. Gary Cohn, Wilbur Ross, Steve Bannon. Aggressive, domineering men accustomed to getting their way by dint of their position. None had government experience, nor did many others in the West Wing. So none anticipated the problems this approach to governing would cause. Trump's self-conception as the all-powerful apprentice boss blinded him to a fundamental truth of the modern presidency, that the president needs Congress more than Congress needs the president. Trump's domineering instinct served him poorly, since most members of Congress are secure in their jobs and accountable mainly to their own constituents. And it backfired disastrously when Trump fired Comey, after he refused to submit to a pledge of loyalty to the big boss. Trump ran against the Republican Party, Wall Street, and Paul Ryan, but then took up their agenda. Populists often struggle to govern, but Trump scarcely attempted to lead the populist revolution he promised. In May, he told me he would transform the GOP into a workers' party. But while he kept voicing populist shibboleths, the legislative agenda he took up was the standard conservative fare pushed by Paul Ryan. During the GOP primary, Trump had shrewdly sensed its weak point, Ryan's desire to finance tax cuts for the rich by cutting programs such as Social Security and Medicaid harmed the party's white, blue-collar base. Trump told me he'd made this point to Ryan directly. I said, "There's no way a Republican is going to beat a Democrat when the Republican is saying, 'We're going to cut your Social Security,' and the Democrat is saying, 'We're going to keep it and give you more.'" Yet Trump's first legislative push was for Ryan's bill repealing the Affordable Care Act, which would eliminate health insurance coverage for 24 million people, cutting Medicaid, which benefits Trump's working-class voters, to pay for high-end tax cuts. Not only was the bill deeply unpopular, a Quinnipiac poll in March found that only 17% of Americans supported it, but it galvanized grassroots Democratic opposition to Trump. Bannon went along because he thought Ryan had become a convert to nationalism, in the belief that it could give the GOP an electoral hammerlock on the upper Midwest. Bannon also thought Ryan's tax plan, funded by a tax on imports, was the most nationalist feasible plan, and that his former enemy could deliver on it. The great fear among Democratic leaders was that Trump would be true to his word and lead a populist rebellion that would cripple their party. "I know what you're doing, and I'm not going to let it happen," Senator Charles Schumer, the Democratic leader, told Bannon in the early days of the administration. Schumer feared that Trump would begin by pursuing a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, a massive project of roads and bridges that would neatly align with Trump's builder image, produce tangible benefits, win over union voters Democrats rely on, and stand as a testament to what America First nationalism could mean. As it turned out, Schumer needn't have worried. Trump doesn't believe in nationalism or any other political philosophy. He's fundamentally a creature of his own ego. Over the years, Trump repeated certain populist themes. The United States is being ripped off in trade deals by foreign competitors. Elites and politicians are stupid crooks. These were expressions of an attitude, a marketing campaign, rather than commitments to a set of policies. When Trump sensed nationalism was no longer generating a positive response for him, he abandoned it, announcing in April, "I'm a nationalist and a globalist," as if the two weren't opposed. At heart, Trump is an opportunist driven by a desire for public acclaim, rather than a politician with any fixed principles. An early indicator was his decision to fill his administration with veterans of Goldman Sachs. Trump was gratified that they wanted to work for him, and he was willing to heed their counsel despite vilifying Goldman as a candidate. This opened up a rift that didn't exist in his campaign between nationalists like Bannon and globalists like Cohn, a top Goldman executive who became head of the National Economic Council. Bannon's fall from his exalted status as Trump's top advisor wasn't the result of a policy dispute, but the product of Trump's annoyance that Bannon's profile had come to rival his own. Trump grew incensed at the popular notion that Bannon was the one really running the show, that he was, as an infamous Time cover put it, the great manipulator. Soon afterward, Bannon was unceremoniously demoted, though he kept his job and clawed back to a position of influence. "I like Steve, but you have to remember, he was not involved in my campaign until very late," Trump told the New York Post. "I'm my own strategist." For a certain segment of people around the world, the Trump brand holds powerful appeal. It was powerful enough to drive the greatest upset in American political history. Before that, it induced a succession of business partners in places as far-flung as Miami and Moscow, Dubai and Azerbaijan, to team up with Donald Trump. The lure is always the same, that forming a partnership will be a mutually profitable arrangement. No one can sell that idea like Trump. More often than not, however, those partners seem to end up disappointed. As Trump's presidency drifts and the scandals around him mount, the idea that he will follow through on the robust nationalist agenda he campaigned on seems less and less likely, and would be difficult to pull off even if he was inclined to try. Still, every president changes the contours of American politics, and Trump will, too. It may not be nearly as aggressively as Bannon envisioned when the two joined forces, or even necessarily in the direction he wanted. But it is also true that after Trump, Republicans will have a harder time pursuing free trade and open immigration. Perhaps even more significant, the effects of Jeff Sessions's elevation to attorney general will reverberate for years in a way that populist nationalists will approve of. But in the end, it's hard to imagine that Bannon and the legions he spoke for will wind up as anything other than the latest partners disappointed when their deal with Trump turns sour. June 5th, 2017. This is Fred Sanders. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Nationalist Uprising by Joshua Green. This program was directed by Olivia Mackenzie Smith. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2017 by Joshua Green. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.